Good afternoon and welcome everyone to today's SRP Progress in Research Internet Seminar. This is our second session and today we'll be talking about biogeochemical factors impacting in situ remediation of chlorinated contaminants. This webinar is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program. My name is Heather Henry and I'm a Health Science Administrator at NIEHS Superfund Research Program. Today I will be moderating this session. We'll be getting started in just a few minutes, but while we wait for others to log on, I would like to take care of a few housekeeping items. When you registered, you were directed to the seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's webinar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included pictures and short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note the presenters' email addresses are hot linked on that page, just in case you have any questions for them after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the limited number of phone lines, your phone lines were automatically put on mute when you joined the call. We request that you keep your phone on mute for the whole seminar. We have allotted time for questions and answers, at which time you can, you're welcome to take your phone off mute and ask a question. You might want to write this down. In order to unmute your phone, you'll need to press #6 or #6. That unmutes your phone. And then after asking your question, you can put your phone back on mute by pressing *6. So again, that's #6 to unmute and *6 to mute. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of our audio transmission. Also, we ask that you please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. So again, please keep us on mute, but do not put us on hold. By now, all of you should be joined into the Adobe Connect meeting room and should see a number of windows, or as we call them, pods, within the room, which include the presentation materials. The introductory presentation should be visible. If you have problems viewing the slides or shared content, you may click the full screen button, which is in the upper right corner of the shared slide window, and expand the content. To shrink it back down to normal size, simply press full screen again. If you experience other technical issues with Adobe Connect, you may be able to download a portion of the items that will be covered and follow along manually. Please note that we cannot confirm that all portions of a seminar will be available in this manner. The majority of our participants will be listening to the presentation audio online through Adobe Connect. If you have problems with the audio, please check your own PC speakers or headphones. If you are on the phone lines, you may need to turn off your phone's speakers, your computer speakers, or the online audio to eliminate duplicate broadcasts. You may submit questions by using the Q&A pod you see in the lower right corner. You don't even have to wait until the question and answer period to submit your questions. You can send them as the speakers are asking. We encourage you to do so. Please note that questions will only be visible to the host. Other participants will not be able to view your questions. So at the appropriate times for Q&A, I will read the questions out loud to be answered by the presenters. We do have four presentations today, so when submitting a question, it would be really helpful if you include the presenter's name or the presentation number with your question. This will be helpful, especially if we don't have time to get to all the questions right after each presentation. Also, I believe that each of the slides are numbered, too, so if you even had a question and then a slide for which your question is particularly directed, that's also very helpful. If you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, you may use the Q&A pod to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number so we can reach you and help you troubleshoot your problem. You can also contact us. The technical support number is 301-589-5318. Again, 301-589-5318. At the end of the presentation, we'll walk you through our related URLs pod. There we have assembled information that is directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with a soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. You will automatically receive an email once the archive is available, and I believe that email will come from Jean Ballant. who would have sent you the link to today's webinar. So associated with the Related URLs pod is an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the feedback form because we look at your comments as we continue to try to improve our content and the delivery mechanism. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. With that, we are ready to start the session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute. And again, please do not put us on hold. So again, this is the second session in the seminar series showcasing research that is just beginning within a new group of grantees who are focusing on biogeochemical interactions that impact in situ remediation of contaminants. And in this case, we're going to feature researchers who are starting work on related to chlorinated compounds. So without further ado, I would like to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Edward Bauer. He comes to us from Johns Hopkins University. He has several colleagues that he's working with, Michelle Laura, Neil Durant, Amar Wadawan. And at this point, I would like to turn it over to Ed so that he can tell us about dual biofilm reactive barrier for the treatment of chlorinated benzenes at aerobic-anaerobic interfaces at contaminated groundwater sites.
Great. Thank you, Henry, and thank you, Heather, and thanks for the opportunity to talk today. As Heather just mentioned, this is a collaborative project, and what's really exciting for me is that it's really bridging academia, some fundamental research with some applied research going on at U.S. Geological Survey with Michelle Laura, and then we have two folk from Geosyntec consultants who are actually taking information that we develop in the laboratory in the field and applying it at real sites. And so that's Neil Duran and Amar Wadawan. So that's really been a great collaboration so far. By way of background, we're studying chlorinated benzenes, and so there are a number of different congeners of chlorinated benzenes, basically monochlorobenzene. There's three dichlorobenzenes, three trichlorobenzenes, three tetrachlorobenzenes, a pentachlorobenzene, and hexachlorobenzene. And often at waste sites, these can be present as mixtures. And the characteristics of these chemicals are that typically the higher chlorinated benzenes are very hydrophobic, so they have low aqueous solubility, tend to partition in the sediments, a lower mobility, whereas the lower chlorinated benzenes with the fewer chlorines will have higher aqueous solubility, can be volatile even, and have high mobility in the aqueous environment. And so this is pretty well true for any chlorinated compound. The more chlorines, the more hydrophobic it is. And so we're trying to look at various principles on how we can handle mixtures of chlorinated benzenes, how best we can remediate them and use biodegradation pathways. We know from the literature that in terms of pathways for degradation, shown at the bottom here, let me get the arrow started, is that basically some of the pathways are biodegradation, and one is a reductive dechlorination pathway where you remove subsequent halogens, making the lower chlorinated compounds. And then there can be photolysis, has also been shown to be important. And finally, if you have enough reductive dechlorination, you can end up in benzene. But what do we know about the degradation of these compounds? Well, we know that aerobically, many of the lower chlorinated compounds can be oxidized, so chlorobenzene can serve as a carbon source and electron donor. Oxygen is required as a terminal electron acceptor, and this has been reported in the literature up to tetrachlorobenzene and lower compounds. And, of course, the benefit here is we get mineralization of the carbon dioxide, and the chlorine comes off as hydrochloric acid, HCl. And the fewer chlorines you have on the molecule, the faster the rate of degradation. And then the flip side, if you want to look at anaerobic processes, we find that the higher chlorinated compounds can be dehalogenated to the lower chlorinated benzenes. This is through a reductive dehalogenation process. It needs a separate electron donor, so you have to have anaerobic conditions, having external electron donors available for that. And chlorobenzene can actually serve as a terminal electron acceptor in some cases, and you end up cleaving the chlorine for that. And in this case, the more chlorines you have, then the faster the rates, and as you subsequently remove chlorines, those rates will get slower. Now, the motivation for our work has been a field site in Delaware. This is a Superfund site called Standard Chlorine of Delaware, and it's located in Newcastle, Delaware, and it's been a chlorobenzene manufacturer for several decades, from 1996 to 2002. It's located in a heavily industrialized area, and throughout its operation, there are two documented major spill events. There probably were a lot of other minor ones, but there was a railroad tanker car that spilled chlorobenzene on site, and there were a VOC tank spill that they say spilled close to 570,000 gallons of VOCs at the site. So that's a huge number, or used quantity, that has been spilled, and it's been an EPA-managed site since 2002. And so this area is located in the Delaware River watershed, and so there's potential for both human exposure through surface waters and groundwaters, and then there's aquatic life being exposed through the wetlands in terms of fish and other aquatic organisms. And so there has been extensive remediation on the site to remove some of the hot spots, but the wetland area, which appears in this next slide, that here's the site, and then in the red box is basically the wetland area. There's evidence that the chlorinated benzenes are seeping into this area, and actually concentrations can be pretty high. They've been detected, for example, chlorinated benzene as high as 75 milligrams per liter in the water that is emerging from the subsurface. And so this area is an aquatic ecosystem. It's also a Potomac aquifer. A deeper aquifer is a drinking water source. So if water were to breach the confining layer, that could also be an issue. And so this was the motivation. USGS has been working on this site, Michelle Laura and her team, for some time to sort of strategize how best we could use bioremediation. And then with this funding opportunity, we wrote a proposal to really try to work more fundamentally so we can optimize a system of treating this site. And so the second bullet shows our concept. If we want to have an in-situ flow-through system that can degrade and remove these chlorinated benzenes before the water reaches any receiving water, like the creeks in the Delaware River. And of course, to be effective, the degradation must be complete. If we only have partial dechlorination, then we could end up with benzene, which is potentially more hazardous than some of the parent compounds. So the next slide shows us our concept. We call this our dual biofilm reactive barrier. The idea here is that as groundwater is flowing upward, leaving the wetland system or leaving the aquifer and becoming part of the wetland and the surface waters, that we can basically intercept that groundwater with this barrier. And if we have high hydraulic gradients, then we would only need a thin barrier here. We use some sort of geotextile to make sure we're not disrupting the solids in the area. And this barrier would have a combination of anaerobic organisms and aerobic organisms. Also worked at Michelle Laura has done at USGS. They've isolated an anaerobic consortium. They've labeled it WBC2, and this has been shown to be quite effective at reductively dechlorinating chlorinated solvents. And so this organism can remove a lot of the chlorines, and then when we have an aerobic culture, the idea is that the aerobic culture can then oxidize those chlorinated compounds. We would basically package this barrier with granoactivated carbon or another adsorbent. This way, at least we have sorbent protection, so we can get sorption of compounds. Particularly, that helps smooth out any fluctuations in concentrations. We know that an adsorption process can smooth out fluctuations and then allow for uptake in the absence of degradation. But then when you have degradation long term, that would be the main mechanism of removal. And so the idea is to package a barrier with both the anaerobic organism basically first, so that it would get reductive dechlorination, and then the aerobic zone would be on top to allow for aerobic biodegradation. We would envision a thicker barrier, though shown down below. So if we have very shallow hydraulic gradients where much slower velocities, then we could get by with a larger reactive barrier, but we don't need the geomembrane because we don't have the flux of the groundwater that could disrupt the subsurface. So we can work on it both in a slow or fast-moving hydraulic gradient system. Just to show a little bit, there's been some literature in the past few years to look at sort of some of these anoxic or oxic-anoxic interfaces. So it's been of interest for some time because a lot of groundwaters can turn anaerobic. Sort of the existing paradigm has been in the absence of oxygen, sometimes when compounds have been disappearing, we've been attributing that to anaerobic oxidation. But in fact, we're finding now that some locations, even though we're getting oxidation, it's likely because of small amounts of oxygen. And so here are some papers in the recent years. For example, isolation of aerobic vinyl chloride oxidizer from anaerobic groundwater, rethinking our oxic-anoxic interface. And so what we're seeing is that, in fact, what could be happening is that there's trace amounts of oxygen in the system, and what we'll do is you get aerobic oxidation even though the environment appears to be anaerobic. And that's what we're trying to exploit here, is looking at the combination of anaerobic and aerobic degradation of these compounds. Just to help confirm that, Michelle Laura at the site had put down what are called biotraps in some of the shallow wetland wells. And what these are made by Microbial Insights. And so ahead of time, they package these in little porous pods with some sort of media, plastic media, and they had this C13 label monochlorobenzene in them. And one set of these traps didn't have any organisms. They called monitor natural attenuation. Get my little green arrow here, monitor natural attenuation. So this is basically the native microorganisms. And then this is this culture, this optimized culture, WBC2, for anaerobic processes. And what was done is these were basically dangled in these monitoring wells for a period of time. They get taken back and analyzed. And so what was found was that in the case for the monitor natural attenuation, there's evidence that some of this monochlorobenzene was incorporated into the aerobic organisms or aerobic oxidation into the biomass. And so this is proof that it was an aerobic oxidation taking place. In the anaerobic culture WBC2, C13 carbon was found in the carbon dioxide, but not in the biomass. So this would support the notion that this WBC2 is undergoing reductive dechlorination of the compounds, but only under the monitor natural attenuation were we getting incorporation of the carbon into the biomass. And the last slide of results showing here is preliminary results that we have, is that there have been two columns that have been run at the USGS laboratory where there was a reactor that contained native microorganisms. At the top is the top portion giving you concentration of some chlorinated benzenes versus time of operation. And then the bottom reactor was with the WBC2. So the top reactor were some organisms that were isolated from a well taken at the site. And what was done is initially these were operated under anaerobic conditions. So the initial period, both in the, with the native microbes and with the WBC2, is anaerobic. And we're looking at the inlet concentration of the chlorinated benzenes and then the effluent concentration, or what's labeled here as waste. And so even during the anaerobic period, we saw substantial loss in both cases of the chlorinated benzene, showing we were getting a removal through degradation. For some period with the natural organisms, it went the system was converted to aerobic, and we saw then the concentrations go much lower, but the aerobic conditions were very favorable for degradation, and even in the feed tank, we were seeing some contamination and some loss of the chlorinated benzenes. Going back to anaerobic conditions, we were able to maintain the chlorinated benzene low levels, and then again aerobically it maintained that. So once we achieved sort of a pseudo-steady state, we were seeing very good removal efficiencies of the chlorinated benzenes, and also with the WBC2 reactor, we were seeing some transformations as well. So this is the motivation for trying to explore this in more detail. And just to wrap up here, we have our research aims for this project as we started in the late fall, and we are starting off with some of the initial results here, is that we really want to do more fundamental work to look at this biobarrier approach with the GAC so we can quantify biofilm growth on the GAC and the dechlorination activity. We need to assess the long-term stability of these mixed cultures, having that anaerobic zone and the aerobic zone, and then understand some of the effects of biogeochemical conditions on adsorption and degradation, things like pH, concentrations of chlorinated benzenes, alternating oxygen and anaerobic conditions, and then ultimately optimizing the barrier performance so we can take that out to the field. I will say we've recruited a doctoral student at Stephen Chow. He's starting to work on this research project, and he's working on some initial microcosm experiments to look at some absorption-desorption experiments to get a sense for the capacity of these barrier systems so that when we start layering on top of that degradation, we'll be able to tease out biodegradation from the absorption. We're going to be looking at effects of natural sediment and groundwater constituents on absorption behavior to make sure we quantify that. Looking at bioavailability of these adsorbed chlorobenzenes, so what will happen is that if we have adsorption occurring, we're looking at desorption and how the biofilms can degrade the chlorinated benzenes that are there, and look at various biofilm coatings, how they would affect sorption. So that's the initial phase, is really to get us involved in the biodegradation desorption processes. And with that, I'll stop. I think I've taken up my 15 minutes, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Ed. And yes, we do have some questions. We have some that have come online, so I can start with those before moving on to the phone. But if those of you are on the phone, I will give you a chance so you can start thinking about formulating your questions. And those of you online are welcome to submit at this point. Ed, we got a question from Michael Lee about midway through. He was asking about how much dissolved oxygen is required.
Well, basically, when you do the bio-G chemistry here, we don't detect the oxygen. We see iron in the system, we see sulfur, reduced sulfur, so we're not able to detect measurable amounts or very little measurable amounts of oxygen. So that's when these articles are coming out showing you basically even trace levels. So you're really near basically detection limit for oxygen in these systems.
Okay, great. Thank you. Eileen Hughes asks if tidal effects have been considered.
Oh, definitely. That's going to be one of the challenges here, too, is because it is a wetland system impacted by tidal action. And so that's one of the reasons why we have this mat system and with the GAC to help keep that barrier intact. But that will be one of our, at the field site, that's going to be one of our challenges when we actually implement the system.
And do you have any idea if there are any preferential pathways in tidal as a function of tidal effects?
Well, we certainly would expect any groundwater flow system some preferential pathways of the water exiting. But that's the benefit of having this mat system, so that it would be able to, wherever the water is emerging, exiting, then you'd be able to handle and treat that water.
Yeah. Okay, great. And then Eileen also asked why so much more variability with the aerobic.
Yeah, I think that was just our first study. We have to do more refinement of that process on there. But may Michelle Laura, maybe she would like, if she knows the answer, I think she's on the line, if she wants to answer that question.
Michelle, you there? You can either answer in the question answer, if you are on the phone, you would need to press #6 to unmute your line.
Yeah, I thought she was going to be on the line. Maybe she is, but can't make it work.
All right. We'll get back to Eileen with that nuance. And Mark Turner asks, has this been in place along the deep cutoff wall installed on site, or is this planned to be installed there?
This is definitely planned to be installed. So this is our concept at this point. So we really have to do the work we're doing in our laboratory is going to help define the parameters for that biobarrier system. So we have to prove that we can do it and maintain that as a stable system. So right now, it's really, the concept is that we can have these two anaerobic-aerobic zones linked, but to actually carry that and pull that off is what our experiments are going to be aimed at.
Yeah, no doubt. So Suhail Al-Abed asks, how do you overcome the absorption of contaminants onto the organic carbon in the sediments?
There could also be some of that, but at this point, this is a passive system, so we're treating the water that has emerged with the chlorobenzene in it. So if it's absorbing in the aquifer itself or in these solids, it'll take longer for it to desorb, but again, the benefit of the system is it's passive, so that as the water continues to exit with chlorobenzenes in it, we'll treat that, and as the chlorobenzene concentration gets lower and lower, it'll cause desorption of the existing chlorinated benzenes in the sediment organic matter.
Okay. So some really great questions. I do want to see if our phone participants have any questions. If you do, would you please press #6, introduce yourselves, and ask your question. So again, anyone on the phones, if you'd like to press #6 to ask a question, please do so right now. Okay. Folks are shy out there, but that's okay because we've gotten some more great online questions. Again, from Eileen Hughes, is this concept supported by wildlife and coastal agencies?
Gee, Michelle, are you there? Can you answer that? I'm assuming yes, because she's been working at the site for a few years, and we have EPA Region 3, I know, involved, so we've been able to make good headway, at least in terms of the concept, and they are supporting this concept as well. So.
Okay, so Michelle did reply about the variability, so I can answer her question, and she has also just chimed in and said it is accepted by the ecosystem regulators to answer Eileen Hughes' question about whether this concept is supported by wildlife and coastal agencies. Michelle did want to go on and provide a little more information about the variability. Again, Michelle, Laura is Ed's collaborator. She says that the aerobic bioreactor was more variable because the input concentrations were degrading so fast in the inflow tank. We kept spiking additional VOCs to the input tank to be able to see degradation. So hopefully that answers the question sufficiently. We do have another online question from Karen Kinsella. Have you considered facultative aerobes using nitrate as a chlorobenzene degrader?
We have not, because we know that at the site that the oxygen will be available, and we didn't want to have to introduce nitrate for that. So we're going to start with this WBC2 that we know is optimized for the anaerobic processes, and then we know that it'll be aerobic because exposed to oxygen. If you get into the facultative system, then you have to have a source of nitrate, which there isn't that much there of nitrate.
Okay, that's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
Great, and again, your field study plans, how far along would that be? Or I realize you're still in the feasibility stage right now.
Right, so this will be a cooperative venture because EPA is providing some funding for the field site work implementation, and then we'll be able to use the NIEHS funds to be able to go and do better instrumentation of that. So this is a four-year award, and so the EPA money will be coming in by the end of this year, and so that we can start doing some implementation in the field, but we still have a lot of lab work to do to really make sure we have confidence of moving to the field. So we don't want to move to the field too quickly at this stage.
Gotcha. Okay, we will keep posted on your work when we do another one of these webinars in a couple of years. But we certainly thank you, Ed, and your collaborators, Michelle, Neil, and Amar, as well as clearly you've been working with some people at the EPA and Microbial Insights and other groups, and so thank those people also for their cooperation in this research project. If there are any other questions that come up for Dr. Bauer, feel free to send those along, and we'll ask Dr. Bauer to answer them separately. Just be sure to indicate in your question that you want your question to go to Ed Bauer. Okay, we're going to move on, though, to our next presentation, which will feature work by Jay Gann and Link at the Department of Environmental Sciences at University of California, Riverside. And today they're going to be talking about understanding aging and contaminant bioavailability in remediation. And so I'm going to turn it over to Jay and Dan, who I believe will be tag team speaking for this presentation. Jay?
Yeah, here. Thank you, Heather. Is this working fine?
Yes, sounds great.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Heather. Thank you guys for having us here. First of all, just a few words about our team here. Dan is an aquatic toxicologist. I'm an environmental chemist. Both of us work in the same department here at UC Riverside. Because we have complementary skills, so we have often collaborated in research, including a previous SRP project on developing bioavailability measurement techniques. And this new project we have here is a significant extension and also a new application of the previous project. So here I would like to tell you what we propose to do and why what we propose to do is important. And we will then briefly explain how we will carry out our studies. Well, many of us know that for many contaminants, what we see in the environment is often not directly related to the associated toxic effects, as we typically measure only the total or the bulk chemical concentration that, in the case, for example, in sediment or soil, really it consists of several different forms of concentrations. So to bridge the contaminant occurrence in the environment with bioaccumulation or toxic effects, we really need to incorporate the concept of bioavailability. And bioavailability, as we know, really is typically measured by either C-free, the freely dissolved concentration, or what we call bioaccessibility. Well, one scenario that bioavailability is really important is aged contamination. I think it's fairly accurate to say that almost all the contaminants at Superfund sites are aged contamination, because the contamination really is typically from many years ago. In the case of the, for example, in the Palos Verdes Superfund site here in Southern California, the contaminants DDT and the PCBs, they were discharged in the 1950s and 1970s. So these chemicals have been in the same sediment for 40 to 60 years. So the same probably can be said for a lot of other Superfund sites as well. And now if we use sediment or soil as an example and look at the microscopic level, over time, the more readily available molecules are either degraded by microbes or they can be consumed by organisms such as small invertebrates, plant roots, for example, in soil. So leaving only the molecules that are less accessible, like inside the particles, leaving them there. It is also very likely that over time, molecules slowly diffuse into the inside of these particles, making the molecules less and less accessible. In other words, over time, as contaminants age, the non-accessible portion of this contamination will increase, indicated here as red, will increase over time. That is to say that aging decreases bioavailability of a contaminant. This phenomenon, of course, has been observed in early studies. For example, studies by Martin Alexander at Cornell University many years ago showed that earthworms accumulated much less DDT from freshly spiked, much more of DDT from freshly spiked soil than from soils with aged DDT residues, even though the total concentration of the DDT or DDE were still the same and the soils were the same. Aging has really several important implications when it comes to Superfund sites. For example, if aging has already decreased the bioavailable concentration to a safe level, we would not need to perform remediation on that site simply because the total concentration is still above a benchmark value. Aging should also be considered as part of a natural attenuation process. However, even though aging is one of the most common features for all Superfund sites, and it also seems to be such a good topic to study, we really do not have a very good understanding about contaminant aging. So this really is the motivation of our for our project. And in this project, we propose to first optimize a bioavailability method to measure aging, and then to apply the method to quantitatively evaluate the relationship between contaminant aging and bioavailability at the Palos Verdes Superfund sites, using the Superfund site sediments. We will then try to explore the effect of black carbon amendment in enhancing aging. And the ultimate goal here, of course, is to incorporate aging effect in future risk assessment and also remediation management. Under specific aim one, we will optimize and apply a method called isotope dilution method, as you can see here, to measure aging. And this method is really the outcome of our last SRP project and has been published in several articles already. The principle of the method is to measure the accessible fraction of the total contaminant concentration. So it gives a value E. And E is a fraction. If E is 1, that means all the contaminant is bioavailable. If it is less than 1, that means that some of the contaminant is not bioavailable. So for aged contaminants, we expect E to be smaller or maybe even much smaller than 1. This is the flow of the method. In reality, it is a fairly simple technique, and I think almost all wet chemistry labs with a mass spec nowadays can do this. So if you are interested in this technique, you can email us. We can send you copies of the published papers. In the interest of time, I will not get into the details. Under specific AM2, we will use sediment cores taken from the Palos Verdes Superfund site. We will use here, in this case, archived sediment cores. And these cores were taken by the LA County Sanitation District, who also happens to be our collaborator for this project. In this sediment cores, we can assume that the deeper we go, the more aged the contaminants would be, because accumulation of sediment, as we know, happen over time, with the newly deposited sediment sitting closer to the surface. And these sediment cores have been sectioned into 2-centimeter increments, and we will use also lead 210 dating. And this part of work is going to be done by a collaborator from University of Florida. We will determine the exact age of the sediment, and we will then use our bioavailability method to measure the E values. And we will then analyze the correlation between E and the sediment depths, as well as between E and sediment age. And we expect that the deeper we go, the smaller the E value would be, and therefore the less bioavailable DDTs and PCBs would be in this sediment course. Under specific AM3, we will try to understand if carbon amendment would accelerate the aging of contaminants. As we know that carbon amendment is considered to be one of the most promising remediation techniques, and it has been tested on various scales. The idea, of course, is pretty simple. Black carbon, such as active carbon or charcoal, have very large surface areas and also have numerous micro and nano pores. So they are very effective at absorbing or immobilizing contaminants. So one may also expect that in a black carbon amended sediment or soil, contaminants such as DDTs or PCBs or PBDEs, they would diffuse into the smaller numerous pores in the black carbon. And this interaction should act to really accelerate contaminant aging. So if this is true, this would be an added benefit for the use of black carbon materials and other materials that we may use as amendment materials that are operating on the similar principle. So with this, I'm now going to turn over the presentation to Professor Schneck.
Thanks, Jay. The fourth aim of this particular project is really more of a confirmation and sort of an application of the tools that have been developed in Jay's lab. and that we had actually had developed in the previous Superfund grant that we had looking at this same Superfund site. So the idea, at least from our perspective, is to confirm some of these bioavailability estimates, which are made, again, in some of the sediment cores, as well as we also will apply this to a freshwater lake sediment, which is McGrath Lake, which is another, although it's a coastal lake, it actually is a freshwater environment, to see how the freshwater sediments compare with the marine sediments of the Palos Verdes coast. The idea here is then estimate by accumulation to food fish. These would be primarily from trophic transfer factors from sediments to biota, and then calculate risk factors for humans as well as ecological receptors for these contaminants. So this is just a slide showing some previous results that we've seen before with the IDM method. This is some work that was published in ES&T as well as another paper in Environmental Toxicology and Chemistry that shows pretty good correlations between what we estimate bioavailable fractions to be and those that are actually measured in Neanthes worms that were naively exposed to sediments. You can see that here on the right. These can be purchased commercially and then applied to sediments undergoing exposure. And the idea here is not only to confirm the bioavailability, but then actually use those as a feeding mechanism to fish that would actually be a source of consumption for humans. We've provided California halibut as the model, but actually we've used another fish species that represents the same niche in the Palos Verdes coastal area, which is the hornyhead turbot. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a little bit. Here's McGrath Lake, just to give you a sort of a bird's eye view of where this is located. It's actually in Ventura County, in north of Los Angeles. You can actually see it's fairly close to the coast, but it's actually a freshwater lake. And you can also see, again, the historical impacts here of agriculture that discharge into this. It's actually 303 delisting for DDT in the sediments with concentrations, again, ranging in the parts per million levels, but recently more, I believe in 2007 or 8, those values have dropped so substantially. So there's a lot of interest in trying to figure out what's going on here, if there's actually, again, an aging issue or not, or whether or not the sediments actually has moved the contamination around in that particular lake. So, again, just something to compare with PV from freshwater. In this particular case, since it is a freshwater system, we will vary our polychaete in the marine system to this particular organism, the Chironomid tentans, which is a very typical bioassay organism for sediment toxicity. The idea here is to, again, use those as a loading vector for fish consumption. This is some preliminary data, and although this looks like a very simple figure here, this took more than a year and a half to actually generate, primarily because it's very difficult to determine how long you actually can allow worms, in this particular case, the Neanthes, to survive in the sediments. Many of these sediments, particularly from Palos Verdes, tend to be quite toxic. So this is just some data showing that we can actually get a part per million, in this particular case, just over 3 parts per million concentrations in these Neanthes worms by feeding them to the sediments. I think this took about 4 days to actually reach these concentrations. And then we can actually feed these two fish, in this particular case, again, hornyhead turbot, which represent a sentinel for California halibut, and we can actually get into the about four to five parts per million concentration for those fish. And if we see, these are some historical values that Eddie Zung published a few years ago, about 13 years ago, you can see that we actually can reach some of the sort of worst case scenario concentrations, at least in the fish muscle level in the about the 2 to 4 parts per million range. So it seems to be a fairly a good mechanism to actually get those values into the fish, which we would also apply to evaluating the ecological effects of these contaminants, as well as confirming some of the model trophic transfer factors that have been estimated through a number of documents, which I'll talk about here. This is the there's a recent draft of for DDE that's just come out from US EPA, Office of Water. They've used accumulation factors or trophic transfer factors from EpiSuite, which is an Arno and Gobus model, which we also have proposed to use as well. I believe there's another model that's out there by HydroQual that was utilized in the feasibility study that Region 9 had actually utilized to determine whether capping should take place or not. So there's a number of models out there that that actually would be nice to confirm or not to confirm. So that's the purpose of kind of doing the feeding trophic interactions there. The other unique aspect about this particular system is there's a wellspring of data really on seafood habits of recreational anglers, particularly in Santa Monica Bay. Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, who we're in collaboration with, has provided a lot of information with this. Obviously, we have the NHANES database, which gives us some dietary exposure to, again, sort of look at worst-case scenarios for different age groups. There's OEHA has a document out that actually has a number of different values that can be utilized in this capacity based on the Santa Monica Bay Seafood Consumption Study, which looked at about 380 anglers of different ethnic persuasions and different consumption modes that is still being utilized today to set thresholds for exposure and for relative effects from fish consumption. So again, the focus here will be looking at subsistence anglers and some of the sensitive NHANES age group. There are some lower age groups, children, for example, age groups that can be utilized here. Idea here is to get some daily, monthly, and lifetime dose estimates. We would then, of course, look at non-cancer endpoints as well as cancer endpoints using a number of thresholds from Cal-EPA, OEHA, as well as EPA that's out there for that. So the idea, again, is just to apply the application of the method that we're using for determining bioavailability to the initial organism, the benthic invertebrate, and then, again, estimating that and then hopefully confirming that in laboratory studies to humans and to other ecological receptors. So the research team here, we've been able to recruit a couple students here, Allison, who actually attended the meeting in San Jose recently, and who's a first-year student in the environmental toxicology program here at UCR. We also have a postdoc employed in Dr. Gann's lab. I'd like to really highlight our collaborators here. We could not do this without LA County Sanitation District. They're providing everything we need in terms of sediments, sediment cores, field samples that we can use for comparison, a host of different expertise. Their interactions with Region 9 as well, we are able to sort of liaison with them through this through these individuals as well. I'd like to also thank or acknowledge Dr. Keith Maria and Wayne Lau at SCWRP. This is, again, is the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, who's done a tremendous amount of work in this area and has been a tremendous help with us and will be, particularly in the risk assessment component. And then Jay had mentioned Professor Brenner at University of Florida, who's going to help with our aging sediments. So with that, I'll take any questions you have.
Thank you, Jay and Dan. That was a fantastic overview of the work you're going to be doing with a nice team of collaborators and researchers. We did have some questions come in online, so I'll go to those first. And those of you on the phone, if you do have a question, you can start thinking about it. I'll give you a chance to ask your questions in just a minute. A question came in from Michael Lee, asked, how deep in the sediments does the DDE and DDT extend?
Okay. Yeah.
Jay is going back in time.
Typically, it's about 80 centimeters below the surface. You can see here on the right, this is the vertical distribution of DDT compound, DDE in this case, PPDDE, from different years. You can see that DDT really was mainly in the sediment from 0 to 60 centimeters. And below that, probably that was pre-DDT time. So you didn't have a lot of DDT below the 60 centimeter.
That makes sense. Thank you. A question came from Eileen Hughes. She asks, carbon may accelerate aging, but is there a hysteresis? Has desorption been considered?
That's a good question. You know, when we talk about bioavailability, it's always a balance between sorption and desorption. And from my own experience working with black carbon materials, typically for these chemicals, the hysteresis would be very strong. So that in itself, I think, would contribute to decreased bioavailability. So maybe some of the chemicals will come out, but they will come out at a very slow pace. So in that sense, I think still it's the bioavailability is diminished.
Great. At this time, are there any questions online from our participants? If so, all you need to do is press #6 to take your line off mute. Again, for anyone on the phones, if you have a question, #6 to take your line off mute. Okay, I don't see any that there are any additional questions. And those of you who are online, you are welcome to submit questions in the future if they come up. All you have to do is, if you would please identify that your question is to Jay Gann and Dan Schlenk, then we will know to send your question to them so they can answer it a little bit later. In the interest of time, though, let's go ahead and move on to our next speaker. Thank you, Jay and Dan, for your presentation. And we'll move on now, switching gears a little bit, to talk about biochemical controls over chlorinated bioavailability to organohalide respiring chloroflexi. Frank Loeffler from the University of Tennessee is going to be speaking. So, Frank, are you on the line?
I'm here. Can everybody hear me?
Sure can.
Okay, good. Let's get started. So the title is a little complicated. I tried to explain what's behind it. So I'm the PI of this project, and the co-PI is a chemistry professor here at the University of Tennessee, Sean Campagna. And then another co-PI is Dr. Jun Yan. He's a research assistant professor in the Department of Microbiology. And Burju Simsio is a PhD candidate working on this project. So the motivation is pretty obvious. So this is from a recent National Research Council report. In the U.S., we have about 126,000 contaminated sites. The cleanup costs will exceed $100 billion. The major concern is contaminated groundwater, and the major contaminants of the groundwater are chlorinated solvents. And among the chlorinated solvents, chlorinated ethenes are the major risk driver. So the overarching goal is to advance process understanding how microbes can deal with these contaminants, use this information to improve the technology. Here's the arrow, wonderful. To improve the technology, and that will then help to reduce the financial burden and make implementation of these technologies feasible at Superfund sites and many other sites, and ultimately reduce the risk associated with these sites. So chlorinated ethenes, here PCE, tetrachloroethene, and trichloroethene, TCE, they can be reductively dechlorinated, a stepwise reductive dechlorination process to dichloroethenes, to vinyl chloride, and ultimately to a non-toxic product, ethene. So ethene is non-toxic, that's why it gets a smiley face. vinyl chloride gets two crossbones because this is a proven human carcinogen. The other compounds are suspected human carcinogens. And there was a recent report that TCE may be responsible for the development of Parkinson's disease. So I wouldn't be surprised if this should also have two crossbones, and it's possible that the MCL actually may go down. So these numbers here are the maximum concentration levels enforced by EPA. So the microbiology that can contribute to the degradation of these compounds, there are different organisms belonging to different genera that have been identified to dechlorinate PCE to TCE and cis-TCE, but then they stop. And the only group of organisms that can dechlorinate dichloroethenes and vinyl chloride to non-toxic ethene belong to Dehalococcoides McCartii. And this is an example of one of these organisms that was isolated in my group several years ago. And this is a simplified model how these organisms work. They use these chlorinated compounds as electron acceptors. How do I start the animation? What do I need? Oh, here we go. I got it. So they use hydrogen as electron donor. So the hydrogen is oxidized. The electrons are transferred to the chlorinated electron acceptor. The chlorine substituent is released as chloride. And this process is associated with the transport of protons. And this proton motive force the organism uses to capture energy. So this is how these organisms make a living. What I want to point out here is that this reductive dehalogenase is strictly dependent on a carotenoid cofactor. It cannot function without. And what's interesting is that when we look at the genome of these organisms, they do not have the biosynthetic pathway to make the carotene ring that is required for this carotenoid cofactor. So they must acquire this from someplace else. And there was there were two very important breakthrough papers last year where they did the structural analysis of reductive dehalogenases. And this is, so it basically gave us a structural basis for organohalide respiration. So this is a postdoc at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. We collaborate with him, and he's a structural biologist, and he generated this nice figure showing a dimer of a PCE to cis-TCE reductive dehalogenase. So one dimer up here, one monomer up here, the other monomer down here. What I would like to point out here, this is the PCE molecule being reductively dechlorinated, and this is catalyzed in an active center where we have a carotenoid cofactor in red, okay? And I want to talk a little bit more about the involvement of this carotenoid cofactor in reductive dechlorination. So this is a little complicated. I break this down to make it easy. So here's a carotenoid. We have a few important groups. We have an upper ligand in blue, and we have a lower ligand in red. And if this lower ligand is dimethylbenzimidazole, DMB, and the upper group is the cyano group, then we have cyanocobalamin or vitamin B12, what you eat with your vitamin pills. Now, microbiology makes it a little bit more complicated, and different microbes put on different lower bases in this position here. So there are a variety of different lower bases that organisms, microorganisms, can put in this position. So keep that in mind. There are different lower bases. So now, just to demonstrate the relevance of these cofactors, we use a Dehalococcoides strain. We grow it with cis-DCE. Cis-DCE is dechlorinated to vinyl chloride, and the vinyl chloride ultimately to ethene, non-toxic product. This is in the presence of vitamin B12. If we take the same culture without vitamin B12, there's no reductive dechlorination. There's a little bit residual activity, but the organism doesn't function. It doesn't grow. It doesn't dechlorinate to ethene. So the carotenoid cofactor is important. This is what we know about the biosynthesis of the carotenoid cofactor. So it can be synthesized from scratch, de novo biosynthesis, complicated pathway. And then some organisms can salvage carotenoid from the environment. So basically, dead biomass, carotenoid will be liberated, and they can take up that carotenoid over different pathways and then generate their own coronoid. What I highlighted here in yellow are all the genes Dihelicocoides possesses. So in general, Dihelicocoides cannot synthesize coronoid, and they are dependent on salvage. Okay, they have all the genes to modify coronoid, but they typically lack the genes to de novo synthesize the corin ring structure. So here we use, this is a PC to cis-DC dechlorinator that can generate coronoid. This is a coronoid auxotrophic organism. And we ask the question, can this organism generate coronoid that can support the Dihelicocoides? We did this experiment, co-culture experiment, with the coronoid producer, the coronoid consumer, and asked the question if we see reductive dechlorination to ethene. And that worked out very well. So we, in these co-cultures, the Dihelicocoides, here we use two different strains, they could grow and dechlorinate. We used a variety of different organisms that are non-dechlorinators, and we were a little surprised because they're all coronoid producers, but they did not support the Dihelicocoides reductive dechlorination activity. So we scratched our head a little bit about this finding, but then remember the lower base is very important. Remember this lower base here, and we talked about that different organisms produce different lower bases. So when we actually added this type of lower base to these inactive cultures, you see that they could support the Dihelicocoides dechlorination activity. So the point here is it's not just the corin ring structure, it's also the lower base that is critically important to support the Dihelicocoides dechlorination activity. Another observation we made, and that's also very important to recognize, so here we have a lower base that supports the Dihelicocoides activity, and here we have a slightly modified structure simply lacking these two methyl groups of this lower base that supports reductive dechlorination. We do see reductive dechlorination to ethene with both lower ligands, or lower bases, I should say. But the rates were significantly different. So with this lower base available, the Dihelicocoides performed much better. We saw fast dechlorination rates and ethene formation. With this lower base, the same culture was much, much slower, and we saw slow reductive dechlorination of cis-DC and vinyl chloride to ethene. So the end product was the same, but the rates were significantly different. So the point is, the Dihelicocoides needs a corin ring structure and needs the correct lower base for maximum activity. And so the idea then is, when you do reductive dechlorination as a bioremediation approach, you stimulate reductive dechlorination by adding fermentable substrate to generate hydrogen, which is required for the Dihelicocoides to perform reductive dechlorination. But then it's obvious that the hydrogen also supports other redox processes catalyzed by microbes. The fermentation bacteria grow up, and they generate different coronoids with different lower bases. And now it's obvious, if you have the wrong population dominating the system that generates the wrong lower base, this can affect the Dihelicocoides dechlorination performance. And this is the goal of this project, to characterize the geochemical environment that allows organisms to grow and generate the correct coronoid and the correct lower base so that the Dihelicocoides achieves maximum dechlorination activity. In addition, we want to use this knowledge we generate to generate a tool that we can assess environments if these genes are present or not. So I told you there are many genes involved in this process here, and we have a high-throughput qPCR tool where we can interrogate up to 224 different target genes of this pathway, and then basically run up to more than 12,000 individual qPCR reactions in a two-hour machine run to interrogate different environmental samples, what genes of Dihelicocoides, these salvage genes or these modification genes, and also what coronoid synthesis genes of the microbial community are active and present so that we can judge if the geochemistry allows the synthesis of the proper lower base. So now my slides disappeared. And it says, share my screen. What do I do?
I'm not sure what happened. It seems everything's working okay, except I'm seeing the same thing you are. Hold on just 1 minute.
Yeah. Okay, it's back.
It looks like it's
right.
Coming back up. You might have to fast forward.
No, it's good. I'm on slide 18. So the point to summarize, so these dihalocucoides that are critically important to achieve detoxification of chlorinated solvents, specifically chlorinated ethenes, require corinoid, and they require the right lower base. So they have a very efficient salvage system to take it up from the environment, and we need to make sure that the right corinoid with the right lower base are available for maximum activity. So the project will explore the biogeochemical environment that enables the community to generate the correct lower base so that the correct lower corinoid can be assembled by dihalocucoides so that we eventually can manipulate reductive dechlorination activity with the goal to enhance this activity. So if you understand the biogeochemical environment for the formation of these lower bases and the corinoids, we can probably improve monitoring regimes and achieve enhanced bioremediation. So for example, we can possibly overcome this often observed cis-DCE or vinyl chloride stall at contaminated sites. So this is the team that I introduced before. I just want to mention that we also have Rob Stefan from CB&I Federal Services on the team. He will help us to collect samples from contaminated sites where we can then demonstrate that the tool we are generating, the high-throughput qPCR array plate, provides meaningful information about the biogeochemical environment that allows maximum dihalocucoides activity. And then we can possibly apply biostimulation approaches that change the geochemical environment so that the community generates conditions that are most favorable for dihalocucoides. And with that, I want to end, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Frank. At this point, if anybody has any online questions, I encourage you to ask them. Find the Q&A window, and you can type in your questions. If there are any folks on the line, I'm going to give them a chance to ask a question now. To ask a question on the phone line, all you need to do is press #6 to unmute your line. And maybe if Lisa Alvarez-Cohen is there, she can say hi, because she will need to press #6 to unmute her line.
Hi there. I'm here.
Hi, Lisa. Do you have any questions for Frank?
No, not at this time.
Okay. So Frank, a question that a lot of folks here on the line are going to want to know is whether field testing is planned or if you're already doing it.
So we're not already doing it, but we have a few sites where we know where we have complete reductive dechlorination to ethene, and we have sites where we see a stall. And additional electron donor addition did not get us over this hump, so we still see cis-DC and vinyl chloride at those sites. So we have different sites that show different behavior, and we will apply this tool to elucidate if the lower ligand availability, the lower base availability, is a reason for these different behaviors at these different sites. We have one site in particular that we are studying that's in walking distance to campus, the contaminated creek sediment, and we established microcosms under different geochemical conditions and are now monitoring what types of corinoid are dominant under these different geochemical conditions and establish cultures with dihalocucoides where we test the activity of DA leukocoides with these different coronoid cofactors that are generated by the indigenous microbial community that we maintain under different geochemical conditions. So eventually we will apply this tool to different sites, and we have a few candidate sites, and that's when we work with Rob Stefan, who will help us to access samples from these different sites.
Great. So certainly something you're working towards. Question from Hussein Awad. How does D. helicocoides athanogenes compare to the organisms you studied?
Okay, so D. helicocoides athanogenes was renamed, and it's now called D. helicocoides McCartii. So the best way to think about this, forget about the name athanogenes. All of the D. helicocoides are now grouped within one genus, D. helicocoides, and within one species called D. helicocoides McCartii. And all known D. helicocoides strains are members of this species, D. helicocoides McCartii.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. So Upal Ghosh asks, what is the exact site of PCE dechlorination? Is it outside of the cell?
No. So these reductive dehalogenases are located on the outside of the cytoplasmic membrane. So technically, they are located in a what we call the periplasmic space that's outside of the cytoplasmic membrane, but inside of the outer membrane surrounding the cell. Okay, so the reductive dehalogenation reaction is carried out on the outside of the cytoplasmic membrane of the cell.
Great. We had a couple questions about vitamin B12. Michael Lee asks, why not just vitamin B12 with the substrate amendment?
Yeah, so this is a logic approach to get over this entire problem. The issue there is that if you add vitamin B12 to a microcosm or probably also to an aquifer, it's very quickly consumed by many microbes. Before the helicocoides shows any activity, all of this vitamin B12 that you're adding has been degraded, consumed, and is no longer available. So you would probably have to make continuous addition of vitamin B12 to have an effect. And that may be too expensive and not practical. So the idea of adding vitamin B12 makes sense, but the experiments that we have done suggest it's very quickly consumed, and before the helicocoides becomes active, it's not there anymore. So this may not be the ideal solution for the problem.
Interesting. Stefan Constis asks, is the coronoid and or lower base being used during the dehalogenation, or is it a catalytic compound?
So it's not the catalytic compound. It's part of the catalyst. So this reductive dehalogenase is an enzyme system that sits on the outside of the cytoplasmic membrane. And this enzyme system only functions when the correct coronoid cofactor is available. So the correct lower base and the entire coronoid cofactor. This is assembled together with the enzyme. If the correct coronoid cofactor is not available, the enzyme is there, but it's not active. So the cofactor alone doesn't really work because this cofactor contains a cobalt ion. And this cobalt exists in three oxidation states, cobalt 1, cobalt 2, and cobalt 3. Only cobalt 1 is reactive. And the enzyme manages to keep the cobalt in this reduced form, cobalt 1. When you remove the enzyme, you can reduce the cofactor to cobalt 1, and it does one reductive dechlorination step. But then it's not re-reduced to cobalt 1. The point is you need the coronoid cofactor and the enzyme to make this a sustainable process.
Right, okay. A question from Karnan Remanand, and this is with respect to B12 formation. Is there a relationship between H2 amount and geochemistry on the CIS-DCE and vinyl chloride dechlorination.
If there's a correlation between hydrogen and dechlorination activity?
Right.
Well, so hydrogen is required for dihelicocoides to perform reductive dechlorination. So it's the required electron donor. Without hydrogen, dihelicocoides can't do much. Now, hydrogen can also support other redox processes. So if you have too much hydrogen and you have a lot of sulfate in your aquifer, you will also see sulfate reduction. And then it depends how much hydrogen, how much sulfate is available. If these sulfate reducers generate a coronoid and a lower base that doesn't support dihelicocoides, this may not be a desirable process. So therefore, blindly adding electron donor to generate more hydrogen may not in all circumstances give you the desired result of increased reductive dechlorination activity. So you need hydrogen, but you may have to ask the question, what happens if I add too much? Is something happening that doesn't support detoxification? And that has to do with the geochemical environment, and that's what we're trying to explore in this project.
Right, and Eileen Hughes asked kind of along those lines, can samples be taken from where degradation proceeded to ethene and then back engineered to get the geochemical information needed?
This is a very good idea. This is what we are doing. So we are characterizing geochemical conditions that generate coronoid cofactors that work with the dihelicocoides. So we have a test system where we can test under what conditions do these cofactors, are cofactors generated that work well with the dihelicocoides. We then characterize these coronoid cofactors. Specifically, we ask the question, what is the lower base? And then we can correlate production of the correct lower base with the geochemistry. We do the same thing with geochemistries that don't generate lower bases or coronoid cofactors that support the dihelicocoides. And then we get a much better understanding of what lower bases are needed and under what geochemical conditions are those lower bases and coronoid cofactors produced. So this is a very good idea. That's an approach we are pursuing.
Great. And then one final question for Mark Turner, and that's about limestone, whether the limestone environment versus a non-limestone hydrogeoenvironmental regime, if there would be differences.
I have no idea. I cannot answer this question. I mean, this is, I see where this question is coming from and why it's relevant.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But I don't have an answer, but this is a very good idea that we could probably experimentally test.
Mm-hmm.
So I would actually like to, if you could send me an email, I would like to follow up with you on this idea. Maybe
okay.
You can even provide us some samples from a site that has this type of limestone, and we can do some experiments.
Okay, sounds great. So Mark Turner, if you're out there and you heard that, let's try to connect you with Dr. Loeffler.
Yeah, that would be good.
Thank you very much for your talk. Mark, well, we'll put you in touch with Mark because I think he has further questions for you too.
Okay.
At this point, let's move on. And our next speaker and our final speaker today is Dr. Lisa Alvarez-Cohen from the University of California at Berkeley. And she's going to be talking about metabolic interactions supporting effective TCE bioremediation under various biogeochemical conditions. Lisa, thank you for joining us, and it's all yours.
Great, thank you. And I would like to introduce some of my team here sitting with me. I have Sarah Gushkari, who is a PhD student who is working on this project. And I have Kayu, who is a postdoc who is mostly working on a different project but has agreed to help us out with some of the bioinformatics on this project. And then Xinwei Mao, who was part of putting together the proposal for this project and will actively be participating as well. She is also a postdoc. Thank you very much. I'm sorry, Frank, I missed the beginning of your talk, but I assume that you already went through some of this technical background, and then I can skip a lot of it. The bottom line here is this fantastic bug, the Helicocoides mccardii, is an obligate anaerobe who requires halogenated organics for its electron acceptor. The ones we're working with actually use chlorinated ethenes. They require hydrogen as an electron donor. They require acetate as a carbon source. And they, in order to carry out the dechlorination reaction that is going from PCE, TCE, cis-TCE to vinyl chloride, they are passing through cis-TCE and vinyl chloride, which are both more harmful than the parent compounds. So it's important for us to get all the way to ethene, and Helicocoides mccardii is so far the only microorganisms known to be able to do this. In order to carry out that important reaction, they require, let me see if my arrow will work, yes, some important reductive dehalogenase genes, and each of these genes require carotenoids as a cofactor, as Frank was nice enough to go through. So what's interesting about Helicocoides is it lives there in nature. We find it in many, many different environments, but it requires all of these other materials from other microorganisms within the community. And that's what we're really interested in, is materials transfer. So if we look at materials exchanges in dechlorinating communities, mccardii doesn't live alone in nature. And it's really important for us to determine if we want our transformation from TCE to ethene to be effective. It's important for us to understand what materials exchanges are occurring. For example, hydrogenotrophic acetogens might be providing vitamin B12 carotenoids, and as well as acetate. We need the fermenters to take larger organic compounds like lactate whey molasses, whatever you're providing, in order to biostimulate bioremediation. They provide hydrogen, which is used not only by Helicocoides, but also in competition by the hydrogenotrophic acetogens and the methanogens. Where is that arrow? Oh, there it is. I'm trying to figure out how to get that green arrow. There we go. Okay. No, that's wrong. All right. Justin, my green arrow is not showing up.
That's a difficult one. I think there it is. You're using the Mac, so it's out of my realm.
Okay, I got it back. All right, thanks. So I'll have to do that for every slide. Okay, no problem. Methanogens are going to compete for some of that hydrogen, but they also are going to be able to provide some useful things to dehalo, perhaps some B12 forms. And then there are other organisms within these communities that are going to provide things like DMB, which is the lower ligand that Frank was talking about, and things like thiamine and biotin, et cetera. So this is a conceptual slide. We know microorganisms don't exist in isolation in the environment. They form complex ecological interactive webs. And those interactions can be, if we look here at species, if we look here at species 1 and species 2, you could have mutually beneficial interactions, you can have mutually bad and negative interactions, and then you can run the whole gamut. What we're interested in is these interactions here, where at least one of the species is benefiting from the syntrophy or mutualism in this case. So what we did was we started by working with a variety of different enrichment cultures. This particular enrichment culture came from a Superfund site groundwater sample. And we started out by saying, all right, well, if we look at the population dynamics in many of these different communities that are enriched in the presence of B12 or carotenoids or in the absence of B12, what can we come up with commonalities of certain species that are generally present? And so we performed this stable isotope probing of a number of enrichments. I'm just going to show one here. And shown at the top, there's my arrow, shown at the top here is a stable isotope fractionation. The way this works is you feed the culture a radio-labeled, stable stable isotope labeled compound, in this case acetate. You feed it for a short period of time to see where the acetate is taken up. The organisms that take up the labeled acetate are going to have DNA that's heavier than the organisms, DNA and RNA that's heavier than the organisms that do not take it up. And so here we extracted the RNA. We did a fractionation. You can see here both the heavy and the light fractions separate out nicely, and then you can do a community analysis of both. We used iTags of the 16S genes in order to differentiate, and what you're really looking for between the light and heavy is you're saying, okay, which bands are greater in the heavy than they are in the light? And you see the green band, for instance, is greater in the light than the heavy, so that's not one of the organisms that was enriched at the beginning of that experiment. These two blue ones, though, both were, and they are represented by desulfo vibrio vulgaris, Hildenborough, as a matter of fact, and then Pelecinus fermentans, which is PF. We also did a series of metagenomic studies on a variety of these different cultures, and shown here is a 2x2 plot of the coverage of one enrichment culture that was fed high quantities of TCE, enriched on high quantities of TCE. The other was enriched on high quantities of TCE with vitamin B12 added. So this culture over here has no vitamin B12 added. It's all being provided by other community members. And what you look for in a plot like this is the differentiation off of the 45-degree angle. Here is Dehalcocoides. We were able to pull out, this is Kehu's work, he was able to pull out a nice genome of Dehalcocoides there, and then this Villanellosi is actually a Pelecinus. In fact, the PF that I just previously showed you is a member of that. And then here's our desulfo vibrio. And so you can see all three of them are present and well represented in the metagenome here. So this is a very complicated figure that I only want to make a couple of messages about. Frank already showed a representation of this. This is the keg breakdown of the genes required to go from cobalt, getting it into its ring, and then generating vitamin B12. And what one's looking for here, I think I have, there we go. What you're looking for is being able to get from that top to the bottom product, which is our vitamin B12 that DeHalo needs. What he's done on this particular figure is put together three cultures. DeHalo is on the left. In the center is the Pelecinus, and on the right, on each of these rectangles, is the desulfo vibrio. And the gray represents a gene that is missing from the pathway. The red represents a gene that is present in the pathway. And then white are genes that are unidentified. And as you can see, if you look at the left of each of those rectangles, DeHalo is missing a very large number of the genes required to put together vitamin B12, even though it's a requisite cofactor for its dechlorination. Whereas the Pelecinus, you see red almost all the way down, has the complementary genes needed for that. And the desulfo vibrio has a portion of them, but not all of them. So that inspired us to put together a triculture of those three cultures. And here we have a representation of that triculture with the DeHalo down here, which we're hoping to take TCE, BC, and ethene, getting both acetate and coronoids from the Pelecinus. The Pelecinus can ferment lactate but cannot produce hydrogen. It produces instead propionates. And then the desulfo vibrio can ferment the lactate and generate both hydrogen and acetate. There's also an arrow here with carbon monoxide, which is the next story of materials exchange that I want to talk about. But as shown in this figure over here, when we put together this triculture and we grow it sustainably over many subcultures, if we add vitamin B12 artificially, we get very nice TCE dechlorination right off. If we do not add cobalamin or vitamin B12, then and we do not provide the lower ligand that is necessary, that is the DMB, then we get really anemic TCE dechlorination. But when we have the three cultures and we add DMB, then in fact we get the same activity as we have with the cobalamin added. We did some work to look at gene expression in these tricultures, and I'm going to skip that for now, but I wanted to leave it on the slide in case people are interested in looking at the transporters for uptake of the cobalamin and DMB. The next materials exchange I want to talk about is something that we uncovered while using isotopomer metabolomics to study one of the isolates of D. helicocordis mccardii. And in this study, what you do is you use a labeled carbon substrate, and we use a variety of different substrates. And then the microorganism takes the label up into their proteins and puts them into their amino acids within their proteins. What you do is you extract all the proteins, you separate them out into their amino acids, and then you use a mass spec in order to track exactly where the carbons went. It's a way to get at the central metabolism pathway of the microorganisms. It turns out that it had been reported for many years that D. helicocordii has a Wood-Lungdahl pathway, which is a carbon fixation pathway that many anaerobes utilize, but that the pathway of D. mccardii is missing three key genes. What was really strange about this is not that it has a pathway that's missing some genes, but what was strange was that there of all the sequenced D. helicocordis organisms, of all of them, they're all missing the same three genes. And so that means that this pathway has not just been disappearing in a random matter. That means that there's something strange going on. We wanted to study that in more detail. Using this isotopomer work, what we were able to show is that D-halo does indeed take acetate down to serine, and that pathway goes into the C1 carbon pool into methylene tetrahydrofurate. And formic acid also can be taken up by D-halo to produce serine, as a matter of fact. And so this, we were able to confirm that, in fact, they cannot fix carbon dioxide in that manner, but they are able to carry out those portions of that pathway. And that leaves us with methionine, then. How the heck are they making methionine, which is a very, very important amino acid for all microorganisms, if they're not able to go through, if they're missing that gene? And it turns out that, in fact, they're going in the other direction on that part of the pathway, taking acetyl-CoA and cleaving it in half in order to produce one of the methyl groups for methionine, and then the other CO group generates carbon monoxide. And carbon monoxide is a useful thing for some microorganisms, problematic for others. It turns out that carbon monoxide is toxic to D. helicocordis, so in using this incomplete Wood-Lungdahl pathway, it actually is generating something that it poisons itself with. We were able to do careful labeled studies in order to show that, indeed, carbon monoxide is generated specifically from that carbon of the acetate and not from the other two carbons. So in knowing that, we said, all right, well, what happens in materials exchanges with respect to carbon monoxide? Well, it turns out that when we grow D. helicocordis together with D. sulfovibrio, shown here, they're in such a nice tender embrace, the carbon monoxide concentration actually is maintained low. So if we look over TCE doses for a culture of D. helicocordis strain 195 grown by itself, we see that after the first dose, it generates a little carbon monoxide, but with each dose, it's generating more and more, and the carbon monoxide is building up. The reason this experiment stopped at dose 5 is that the cells stop growing at that carbon monoxide level. Whereas when you have the co-culture, the carbon monoxide levels are kept actually quite low, and this one kept going and was able to be given dose after dose after dose. It also turns out that carbon monoxide serves as a potential energy source for microorganisms, and so we grew D. helicocordis culture together with Syntrophomonas wolffii, and we're able to show that cell concentrations of wolffii are, oops, where's my arrow? Here we go. If we look at the left, cell concentrations of wolffii are not affected by increasing concentrations of carbon monoxide, so wolffii doesn't mind having high concentrations of carbon monoxide present. shown here in the center is the co-culture with its carbon monoxide production, and when you grow Wolfii by itself, it doesn't generate any carbon monoxide. So there's a little bit of carbon monoxide that is generated. These are quite low quantities, though, so it's not building up here. In fact, the Centrophomonas has a little bit of a higher yield, showing that in the presence of carbon monoxide, here's the carbon monoxide and Wolfii able to biodegrade the carbon monoxide itself. So this was the first report showing that the Centrophomonas can actually use the carbon monoxide as a source of energy. So in this case, it's a win-win for both microorganisms because the Dihelgacoides is generating this poison that this other organism can actually use as its electron donor. And at the same time, the Centrophomonas can provide things for Dihelgacoides, including hydrogen and acetate. So to then finish this out by talking very briefly about the technical objectives of this particular study, what we want to do is construct TCE dechlorinating consortia of fully sequenced organisms so we can really keep track of all the different materials interactions on a very mechanistic level. And we want to maintain them in chemostats. We think that's important because oftentimes a lot of this work is done in batch studies where the organisms are seeing feast and famine conditions. Whereas in the environment, really what they are exposed to more commonly is a much more consistent and low-level feeding, which is what you would see in a chemostat. So that's what we're interested in doing here, putting these multiple types of constructed cultures into chemostats and maintaining them. And then identifying changes in those microbial communities that occur in response to geochemical perturbations and elucidate the networked interactions. To give you just a little bit of detail on each of those, this is putting together our defined consortia, where's my arrow, into the chemostats, measuring cell activity and metabolite exchange, looking at changes in expression, and then we can put that into quantitative correlations with random matrix theories and metabolomics in order to really get a good understanding of the materials exchanges. Once we have a better understanding of what materials are exchanged within these communities and who is responsible for those exchanges, then it will be much easier for us to, easier for us to perturb those environments for biostimulation purposes. And I think, in fact, I have more details of AIMS 1, 2, and 3 here, but I think for time, I will leave it there and take questions. And the slides here are available for you, so feel free to take a look at them, and if you have further questions about the details of where we're going with this study, I'd be happy to address them.
Thank you so much, Lisa. And again, I certainly do encourage you to take her up on her offer to answer questions that you might have about her approach and the research that she's planning on doing. I do want to, just before we open up to questions, I just want to make sure that everyone knows about the Related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and the seminar feedback link. So on the seminar resource page, we have resources that are directly applicable to today's topic. It'll stay with the seminar indefinitely. Access it after the presentations. We typically place the seminars as an archive with the soundtrack, and it takes about a week. Just today, I got the soundtrack from last week's webinar, so really doesn't take much time. If you do need to come back, they will be there. So in the near future, you can have access to the presentations that were given today. Also in the related URLs, you'll find a seminar feedback form, and we ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your questions. We try to improve the content and the delivery mechanisms, so please do consider filling that out. I do want to make sure that we have a chance to get to the questions for Lisa, and I would encourage you that if you have questions to use the Q&A box and submit your questions. Those of you who are on the phone line, I will give you an opportunity to ask your questions on the phone. In order to do that, you would need to press #6. Right now, I'm going to go to the online questions, and let me start with Michael Lee. Michael Lee asks, do the common bioaugmentation culture KB1 and SDC9 contain the disulfibrio and pineolis?
My understanding, they do for sure, the disulfibrio, pelocinus, do they contain the pelocinus? I'm not sure. Frank would probably have a better idea of that because he's worked more extensively with those cultures.
Frank, if you're on the line and would like to jump in.
So can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm not sure about SDC9, but I'm pretty sure that KB1 does not contain pelocinus. But on the other hand, I'm pretty sure there are other organisms that would fulfill the role of this particular population.
Yes. In fact, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. Thank you, Frank, for that. I totally agree with Frank, and I think the importance here is understanding that the specific name of the specific species is really not that important to us. It's the specific function that they're carrying out. And that's why I think that, that's why I think that looking at a pathway like, sorry about this, it's important to be able to say, okay, well, you know what? I don't care what the name is of any of the organisms in a portion of that rectangle. I really care that the rectangles somewhere are red all the way down. And as long as it's red all the way down, then that function is present in that community, and you're probably good to go.
Okay, great. Teamwork. So Lisa, there was a question about AIMS 1 through 3, and if maybe you could walk through that. Did you have one slide about them? Yeah.
This one? Okay. What was the question?
Just that if you could walk through that, a little more help walking through these slides, so maybe a little more information on what you're planning to do.
Okay, so in AIM 1, we're constructing a variety of different constructed consortia, putting together organisms that can carry out, let me get my arrow back, that will be carrying out the important materials exchanges that are needed to support dehalo growth. And what we want to do that arrow is not going to move. Okay, doesn't matter. And so in AIM 1, we're finding consortia that are able to live together in chemostats, because we already have consortia that can live together in batch reactors, but putting them into chemostats hasn't been done yet. And so we feel like the kind of control that we will be able to exert in a chemostat will be extremely useful for us so that we can do the measurements required for AIM number 2, which is perturbing the chemostats with different geochemical stresses. The geochemical stresses that we're interested in include things like pH. Which brings me to, I loved the question that you had at the end of the end of Frank's talk about what would happen in a limestone aquifer. Because in a limestone aquifer, what you're going to have is a lot more buffering, and the presence of a lot more bicarbonate, and that actually can cause very large changes in the behavior of dehalo. So one of the things that we're actually looking at is changes in pH. We've already been starting some studies on looking at bicarbonate species and the effects of that on dechlorination rates. And we've gotten some results that show that, in fact, there are some very specific influences caused by changes in bicarbonate. And so I think it's going to be very, very interesting to see what happens with the limestone aquifers. At any rate, the other perturbations will be things like acetate concentrations, sulfate, sulfide, and iron species. And then in AIM number 3, in AIM number 2, we'll also be using our microarray to look at expression changes. And there, what one does is look for stressors and stresses that are being exhibited by expression of different genes. We also will be trying to identify different intracellular metabolites. Like the carbon monoxide, there might be other small molecules that are being exchanged between these microorganisms, and we'll be trying to study those with very detailed mass spec studies. And then finally, mapping gene network and interactions. Here we work with Joe Zhu at University of Oklahoma. He's done extensive work in mapping gene networks and interactions between microorganisms in very complex communities. And so here we have an opportunity to map these interactions in very simple communities and get more direct answers with respect to those interactions. And then finally, we're hoping to be able to validate those interrelationships using quantitative analysis on specific targeted metabolites that are identified in both AIMS 2 and 3. How was that?
That was great. Thank you. And I thought the limestone, you know, that's going to be a really interesting aspect. So that is something that you're planning to, that you're working into your work, is what I understand.
Yes, looking at effects of bicarbonate concentrations and pH.
Great. And Mark Turner adds that there are plenty of examples in Tennessee, both aerobic and anaerobic systems. He said, see the Tennessee dry cleaner program for possible sites, maybe landfill sites and karst. This is certainly of interest to you and to Frank, who just spoke. And along those lines, at this time, if there are any questions, again, thank you very much, Lisa, for that overview of your upcoming research. If there are any additional questions for the presenters, any of the presenters, you can send them in. There was one more question for Frank. If Frank, you're still on the line.
I am.
Oh, great. So this was from Mark Turner, and he asks about laminar versus turbulent flow.
Okay, so what's the question exactly? So I assume that has to do with groundwater hydrology.
That would be my assumption as well.
So honestly, I can't answer that question, but it certainly in the end is an important one. So the helicocoides, when it's actively dechlorinating, we found that a substantial number of cells is in biofilms. So it's not planktonic. It's not swimming around in the water. It's attached to surfaces.
Okay.
When they are not growing, the majority of the dihelicocoidal cells are not in biofilms. Then they are mostly found in the water, in the aqueous phase. And then certainly, the biofilm planktonic cell transition is a very complex event, and it's not just true for dihelicocoidal. So when you think about, you know, the transfer of metabolites like lower bases or corynoid, the hydrology has an important role to play so that these metabolites actually reach the helicocoides where it's needed. But this is too far ahead. Right now we are interested in understanding the basic scientific principles of this process. Once we have that understood, then we can think about how can we manipulate a system using possibly hydrology, you know, to make sure that these populations interact in a way that is most beneficial for achieving detoxification. So I think it's an important point, but too early for us to worry about. But this is important later on.
Can I weigh in on that as well, Heather?
Oh, absolutely.
So this is Lisa.
And then if you don't mind, because Mark did provide a little additional, he said also fracture flow, that there are many dry cleaners sites in fractured limestone environments which have laminar and turbulent flow. So, but please, Lisa.
Okay, and I was going to chuckle a little bit because most people working in groundwater aren't in karst and fracture. They're in other things, and they'd say, what do you mean turbulent flow? But I understand where Mark's coming from because he's working in karst and in more complicated flow regimes where you really are going to have a combination of things. and so it's an interesting question from that perspective, but what I put up, I went back to a different slide where I kind of rushed over this element of it. What we found with this co-culture of Centrophomonas growing with the Halococoides was that the rate of their transformation was higher than would have been allowed by them growing in suspense, in suspended culture individually. And as a matter of fact, you see that these cells grow together in clumps. And it's kind of a biofilm type formation, but it's them trying to bring this, their cells together closer, which allows the flux between the two of a hydrogen and carbon monoxide to be much faster than it would be if they were growing suspended. And so we find that, whereas we don't see that characteristic when we're growing the halo with the Sulpovibrio. There we find that they are very capable of growing individually. So it really depends on the types of exchanges that are going on and what is the limiting substrate, whether the electron donor is limited or whether the electron acceptor is limited, whether there are other things there present that can compete. And so in some cases, the halo will grow attached to things and attached to other microorganisms, but they tend, when they're growing by themselves, to simply grow, as Frank had mentioned, you know, to grow on their own.
Okay. That's great. Thank you, Lisa, for clarifying that and providing additional thoughts about that question. At this time, I think it's gotten quiet online, so we don't have any further questions. I would like to thank all of our speakers today. We started out with talking about Ed Bauer's work, moved on to Jay Gann and Dan Schlenk, Frank Loeffler, and Lisa Alvarez-Cohen. On behalf of the Superfund Research Program, we certainly thank you for the work that you've done in putting this together and all the work that your collaborators have put into coordinating with you, in many cases providing training opportunities or providing opportunities to work on field sites and work with real field samples. So we thank you very much, not only to our presenters, but also the collaborators and the staff and the students who are working with these presenters from today. I'd also like to thank Justin Crane for doing the behind-the-scenes work on today's webinar, and also certainly the EPA folks with Cluin and Oswer. We certainly appreciate being able to utilize this webinar format to talk about, again, upcoming research with the Superfund Research Program. We do anticipate, hopefully, in the next year or two to have another webinar featuring these researchers to showcase some of the results that are coming in. Until then, again, we ask that you are able, or again, I'll just point out that you're able to look at the seminar resources page where we've assembled some resources that are directly related to today's topic. And also, if you want more information about EPA's Cluin, there, you can refer to the Cluin website, the EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page. EPA also has an EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter, and you can also join the Cleanup Information Network, which is through Cluin, or excuse me, which is through LinkedIn. The Superfund Research Program also has a Twitter feed at SRP_NIEHS. So I would, again, like to thank our presenters, Ed Bauer, Jay Gann, Dan Schlenk, Frank Loeffler, Lisa Alvarez-Cohen for their time in preparing the presentations for today. And with that, I would like to thank all of you for your participation and conclude today's webinar. Have a